Vita Voices and Views is brought to you by Vita, Women in the Literary Arts, with host and executive producer Melissa Studdard and executive producer digital media R.J. Jeffries.
Beloved poet and poetry magazine editor Dawn Scher was a 2015 recipient of Vita's Vito Award for his contributions to American literature and literary community. In addition to being the author and editor of over a dozen books, Scher is an accomplished translator whose renditions of Miguel Hernandez were awarded the Times Literary Supplement Translation Prize and the Premio Valley in Cannes. As well, Scher's work at Poetry has been recognized with 3 National Magazine Awards for editorial excellence from the American Society of Magazine Editors and a CLMP Firecracker Award for Best Poetry Magazine. Scher is celebrated in the literary community for his generosity, innovativeness, and warm wit. Hi, Dawn. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you tonight?
I'm just great.
I love all the albums behind you.
Poetry, books, and music, right?
Yeah. I was just thinking, I just would love to have some time to comb through all of that and see what's there. Well, I wanted to start by asking you, when you became editor of Poetry Magazine, you wrote a letter to the readers, and you stated that the motive would remain the same, to keep free of entangling alliances with any single class or school,
right,
or simply put, to be eclectic. So what I've noticed is that even as you have done what Harriet Monroe set out to do, there's also like a freshness and a breadth that feels new, like a new scope to it. And it feels almost like you've expanded her original notion of eclecticism to include concerns beyond classes and schools. So I was thinking to myself, like, you have taken the magazine's open door policy and said, well, that's a great start, but I'm going to build some new doors. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you put it better than I could, to be honest. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think it was the right time. It was kind of something that, you know, the magazine wanted to do. And so that's really true. That was part of what I set out to do at the very beginning. And there were a lot of other things you could do, you know, a lot of directions to go while still maintaining that founding vision to which we're very faithful and to which I'm obliged to be faithful. I mean, that's written on the wall literally as well as figuratively where we work. And so I must do that. But with every editor, there's a different way to go about it, a different interpretation, and a different climate in which to work, and a different world in which poetry is functioning. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to take account of all that, and that seemed to me the clear direction we needed and wanted Poetry Magazine to go. So I just, you know, kind of, yeah, built, and I'm still doing it. I mean, because it's a tricky thing. It's like steering a big ship. I mean, I didn't want to sort of turn the place upside down and inside out. Well, I did,
yeah.
But I didn't want to, you know, I needed to retain the valuable and canny parts of the history that I inherited that brought us to a position where we could do this. And so I didn't also want to have a kind of diversity and inclusiveness that actually excluded other kinds of things that had been in the magazine for a long time. I didn't want anybody to feel that they were not welcome in the magazine under my editorship or no longer welcome. I mean, I know people probably do feel things like that. But more importantly, what I wanted the magazine to do was to be open. That's why, for instance, I'm on social media and like talking to you and going places, because, you know, we have the tools to be open that Harriet couldn't exactly have dreamed of, though I sometimes think that she did. You know, she had a news and notes thing that was like Twitter in the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
She was aware that we're all talking to and about each other, and she wasn't afraid of a fight or an argument.
Wow.
And she was very bold, and
yeah.
And so there's a sort of vision there that I do think I'm fulfilling in a way that my predecessors maybe weren't able to, given the environments that they were working in. So I'm quite fortunate to come along in the magazine's history at this moment. And it's quite necessary, too. You know, it seems like really necessary, important work. It feels like we just must do this.
You know, that's a really modest answer. I feel like a lot of it is your personality, actually. It's who you are too. So, I mean, I hope that you'll also take that laurel.
Well, thank you. It is. I mean, that these are my inclinations anyway, and I think I'm able to bring that to bear. I do try to. I mean, it's not humble bragging. I mean, I mm-hmm. do have a great deal of humility. The magazine has been around for 103 years mm-hmm. without me, and it doesn't need me. And I don't want to be the one to wreck it. And I also believe that there are people who are more directly, let's say, part of the diverse ecosystems of poetry than I might be considered. And there are certainly other people who could do the job in different ways. They're much better than I could. But I'm here at this time. This is the plan, and I'm giving it everything I can, including like all of my own sort of energy. But also, yeah, personality plays into it. Yeah. I think just like we talk about Harriet, as if you know she's sitting here with us. It's like that. We got that too. Or some people talk about Henry Rago, you know, and they're like, well, Henry, you know, published Ronald Silliman for the first time in Poetry Magazine, things like that, and. And so, yeah, it is kind of a personality thing, and I don't mind that. I do think the magazine is a lot less of a black box than it used to be. When I started sending work to Poetry Magazine that wasn't going to be published, I first sent to John Frederick Nims, and I would never in those days have had a chance of ever seeing Nims at an event or at an AWP. They didn't have it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have ever been in touch with him about anything beyond the response to a submission. And I remember what that's like. And so I'm, you know, part of the change is my wanting people to feel that I am there for them. We get 120,000 poems a year and Christina Pugh and I read them all. We don't have readers. We don't have interns doing that. I mean, we're behind what we do personally. And I'm happy with that. I like that. I think that's an improvement over the way it used to be where, like, when were you going to meet George Plimpton or these other legendary figures that I looked up to? You know, right. Now I feel like we're all here. You know, people know all you guys at Vita. They know me. I think that's a great improvement. I think it helps create mm-hmm. the kinds of community poetry needs to really reach the places it has to go.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful view. And can I ask, is this a new thing with the just the three of you reading all of the submissions? Did there used to be people who would sort of weed through that?
I'm trying to think of what I can say. Since I've been at Poetry, I've been there, you know, going, well, 8 years now. I was working with Chris Wyman as the editor. When I first came, what they did was all the staff of the magazine, it's a small staff. It's like four people plus the editor, so it's not a big group. And they would discuss everything, and it took a really long time. And then when I came, you know, so there weren't outside people. And then when I came, I think Chris and I felt like we're going to be here all day discussing every poem. We'll never get through everything. And we felt that our names were on at the top of the masthead. Why don't we just, like, live up to the, you know, masthead and we'll read everything with Christina then too as now. And so really it's been the case at least since 2007 and really earlier that everything was read. That was always, you know, the premise. I don't actually know of a time in the magazine's history when there were sort of outsiders that were just reading. They may have had to do that here and there for practical reasons, but it's our tradition, you know, to do the work of discovery. And what that means is you have to look at everything that comes in if it's humanly possible. So that's what we do.
Wow, that's really amazing and noble because, I mean, there are magazines that get far fewer submissions that actually have readers who do that. So,
well, I understand. You know, I understand why people do that. It's a practical thing, you know, and if you want to have a good turnaround time, right now we're at about 4 months, which feels long to me, mm-hmm. but considering everybody gets a reading. But I hope people remember, too, it's not just like a binary thing where you submit a poem, yes or no, it's accepted or rejected. A lot of the work that I do and that my predecessors have done is to keep track of people so that even if you get a form rejection, because I read all this stuff, I know who's who. And most of the people who appear in the magazine have been rejected repeatedly many times. And then when it works out, it's like, well, the editor's job is to sort of get a sense of each submitter, what they're up to, what kind of work they do, where they're going, and the trajectory of their careers and stuff. And so, like, I remember, my job is sort of to remember people, too. They would never know this, but, like, you know, a lot of the people I can remember, we rejected them for years. They'd be very angry, but we were watching them grow as writers and waiting for the right thing for both the submitter and the magazine to come in, and then they do. It's a great process if people bear with it.
That must be so exciting for you when you finally get to tell someone, yes, you're in.
Well, not only that, I mean, I'm really proud of it because another aspect of the work we do is the Ruth Lilly, Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Fellowships, which is for writers under the age basically of 31. That's the terms of that gift endowment. So it's young writers. And I'm just so proud of those guys. Like, three of the five last year have really big book deals coming up. And there is nothing better than that feeling that you have helped a poet get where they want to go, helped support their work, given their work the widest audience that you can. I mean, we're lucky to have that. It's you know, people talk about privilege and gatekeeping and stuff like that. But the way I look at it is it isn't about anything other than my having the chance to put your work in front of a really big audience. And that's all we exist to do. You know, so that's you know, yeah, it is exciting. It's great to see people that we took poems from and then they go on. That's in our tradition. Eliot's first real publication outside of a school magazine was in poetry in 1915 with the Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And from, you know, 103 years ago on, that's what we do. We find people and they go on to something. And you know, that's the best thing we can possibly leave behind for future generations of readers.
That's an amazing thing, too.
Yeah.
Incredible, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to show you. Can you see which issue is behind
me? I certainly can. I recognize that one.
That's my favorite issue in about forever. I just, when I read that, I had never heard of so many of those poets. And I just felt like, I mean, I felt this like incredible excitement. Like, I have to have this breakbeat book now.
I have
to read it cover to cover.
That's what we wanted. I mean, we worked it out. I knew there would be the book. And I knew, obviously, the editors as poets and people in our own community here in Chicago as well. Marshall was in my first issue as editor already. And we just sort of figured out what can we do here? And it was on many different levels. We did a selection for the magazine, timed for the appearance of the book so people would want it. We did an event at the Poetry Foundation, which is one of the biggest events we've ever had. I mean, it was just a huge, diverse, wonderful audience that came to see people in person. And then there was a lot of attention to it in the media. So the idea was, you know, to take a magazine, which is sort of a two-dimensional object, and really bring it to life in every dimension we possibly could. And that was like the perfect model for, you know, for doing that. And that's sort of the high, that's sort of the benchmark. Like I would do that for every issue, every poet if I could, something like that, to just get the excitement, the kindle response everywhere. And it went all around the world.
It should have. It's amazing work. It's just electrifying, you know.
Not everybody liked it. You know,
oh, really?
TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, attacked me for doing it and said, you know, sort of awful stuff about, you know, some of the poets by name. That was a real shocker to me. You know, the august TLS in the UK, which is still very influential around the world, sort of came after us. That was a bit of a surprise. There were some, you know, there were readers who didn't understand or care for that work, but at least they had to encounter it. And that's the point, too. You do have to have a critical discussion about these things.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, you know, when you were talking, I was kind of thinking about, do you remember, like, I think it was like in the 1980s when the movie stars and the rock stars and everybody were getting all they would get emotionally exhausted and have to go into a treatment clinic.
Right.
I don't really see it as much anymore, but just hearing you talk about that, I was like, God, I wonder if he ever gets emotionally exhausted.
Not me. You know, I live to do this stuff. If I got tired, I would be in the wrong job. And I think editors, you know, they have kind of lifespans. You know, I think Chris Wyman was at Poetry for 10 years, and I think you sort of know you when it's time to do something else, and that you don't want the magazine to become stale and jaded, and you know, you don't want people to see every move you're going to make already, and you know, so periodically in the lifespan of a good magazine, which I hope we are, you know, yeah, somebody does need to come along and refresh it. And I imagine what seems exciting and different about what I'm doing, the natural sort of course of several years will seem rote and not right for the times or something. And then, you know, someone else will have to come and reinvent the magazine. But that's part of the great excitement of it, you know.
You know, it's kind of hard to imagine, though.
Well, I don't know. I think about it constantly. I mean, you know, you have to know when it's time to go or you wreck the magazine. And none of us want to do that.
Yeah.
I sure don't want to be the guy to wreck it.
No, I don't think that'll happen.
No.
But, well, okay, so I think we should talk about the pie charts, the Vita pie charts, since we have you here, because I'm sure you know that the past couple of years you've actually really nearly reached gender parity. And
we always worked for that. Before even Vita existed, when I was, you know, working on the magazine, Chris Wyman, we always tried to balance things out. It's funny because in those days early on, like 2007 or so when I first came, we actually sort of tried to calculate gender balance by the amount of space devoted rather than the number of poets. So we were actually using a slightly different metric that could work against us if you counted it a different way. But we've tried to do that. That's a very important commitment, as well as other kinds of balance and diversity, too. In the last year, it was tricky because, as a lot of people have kind of had conversations about, you know, the gender balance thing we have had down, and I could do that, but I wanted to up the ante, just like Vita is, and have other kinds of things enter into the magazine that weren't in it before. And so some things got bumped around so that when I put together issues with real gender parity, something would happen where a feature might reduce the space for the individual poems, or somebody would write and say, my book is coming out next month suddenly, and I had to move things up. So it threw us off a little bit, and so I'm getting back on track now. But yeah, that's always been a very strong commitment, and not just me. I mean, Wyman did it too.
Yeah, because I was looking at the numbers, and it goes a few years back. I mean, to like 2010.
Yes.
It's always been clearly there, but it's also clear that you care about it, that you all make it a priority.
So. It's definitely a priority, and so are other kinds of things. I mean, there's so many things that you want the magazine to accomplish, and so many ways that diversity and inclusiveness can be implemented. It can be, you know, there are a lot of kind of moving pieces to keep track of, and sometimes you do better than others, but it's definitely a commitment. And, you know, as many people have observed, when their periodicals don't seem to live up to it, it's a little puzzling. I mean, it's tricky, but not difficult. That's two different things. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to aim for something, and if you hit the targets right, you have to have skill at it. But it's not difficult. Mm-hmm. The work is out there. I'll tell you, the way that you make it possible is that you want people to feel that their work is welcome in the pages of a magazine. Because, for instance, when other places like, say, the TLS seem to be uninterested in gender balance, you know, for instance, women writers would have to ask themselves, will my work be welcome there? Should I send work to a place like that? And so what I wanted is for people who didn't feel welcome in our pages before to feel that they should be welcome. So you have to also not just count, but you create an environment in lots of different ways where people will not be inhibited from sending work. And not only that, sending work again and again to get in, you know, to affect change in a magazine by kind of becoming stakeholders in it, saying, you know, I want to change this thing and I'm going to look after these guys and make sure they do it. But you have, everybody has to sort of work together to make it happen.
You know, that kind of just in this kind of roundabout way reminded me of this quote that I really love from Stanley Kunitz. And I'm sure you know this quote. He said that in order to be the, in order to write the poems that you want to write, you have to become the person who would write those poems, basically.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny you say that. I have this thing I just got today from, there's the Theodore Zeldin, a philosopher, has a book out, and I was just looking through it. He says, like, in every interaction with people, whether it's a conversation or when you do your work or the way you live, you should ask, he says, what moral, intellectual, aesthetic, and social effects does the work you do have on others, on yourself? Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing Kunitz was getting at. In other words, you do have to think about that stuff. I ask myself that day and night, and, you know, sometimes you let yourself or other people down, and it's hard. You know, the different poetry controversies that happen day to day, every day there are new ones. You know, you do soul, at least someone in my position has to do soul searching, you know, and you have to be very hard on yourself, you know. But I think if we all do that, something great happens.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. It's kind of like, you know, the question then becomes, like, in order to create the magazine that you want to create, you have to become the person who is this editor who,
yes,
right, to get the numbers right. It's not just about numbers, like you were saying. Which is...
Right, and you know, Harriet, in the early days, on the back of the magazine, always put that motto from Whitman, to have great poetry, there must be great audiences, too. In other words, it's a two-way street. It's not just about an editor or a policy or accounting. It's the need that we have for poets to help us accomplish the things that people would wish to see happen. You know, exactly. Early on when I came here, I realized that there were very few, hardly any Latino poets in Poetry Magazine, and I met with people who, you know, had conversations with me about that, very stern ones. I said, here's how it works. Tell everybody you know to send work to this magazine, and then it'll happen. Because if the word was don't bother, change would never come. So I need, you know, I need poets to sort of hammer away and to be persistent and to, that's with the open door implies that metaphor is really wonderful. It doesn't just mean like the door's open, you get to walk, everybody can walk through it. What it means is that somebody greets you. It's a portal that people meet in that entranceway. And so the poets come in one direction, the editors are in the other, and we do something together. It's not, you know, one direction or the other. It's a meeting that must take place. It's an interaction, an ongoing interaction. At least that's how I envision the workings of it.
That is really beautiful. I love that. So before we talk any more about editing, I would like to shift to your own creative work for a little while, because I want to make sure that we have time to do that. You know, I just wanted to tell you that one thing that I really love about your poetry is it feels kind of like a meditation bell to me. I like to meditate in groups a lot, or like a koan, where it'll like kick the reader into awareness in a way that might seem funny or direct at first.
Yeah.
But then it starts to kind of like deepen and reverberate over time. And I mean, I literally, when I was listening or reading your poems, I literally had that same feeling that I feel in my body when the bell is not being struck anymore and you can still feel it kind of reverberating. Like, that's how your poems sort of stayed with me, which I thought
that's
was so
lovely.
Cool.
I really appreciate that. That's beautiful, and I don't know, I'm abashed.
Oh, well.
I'm blushing.
Own it, I guess.
Yeah, I'm happy to.
But I wanted to ask you to read a couple of poems.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
And so you have to tell me what they are.
Yeah. Telling you which ones I want you to read. The first one that I would love for you to read is Food for Thought from Squandermania.
Uh-huh. Got it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I
printed out your poems to have with me so I could have the book on the shelf.
Thank you. Well, so here's the book. That's really interesting choice. Go ahead.
Really? Tell me why.
No one's ever asked me about this poem, and I tended to stop reading it because I think there was I go through a phase, you know, we were talking about self-doubt, and I thought, maybe I'm being too, like, internally meditative on these things and drawing in stuff, you know, and so, you know, to me, poems really are food for thought in many senses, not just the cliche, but that they nourish us, you know. And so food for thought as an expression has to be redeemed from being a cliche into a statement of what we do as poets. In other words, every time because of what I do, reading so many poems all the time and being in service to poets, when I come to my own stuff, I have to say, why am I doing this? Does the world need another poem? I know how many poems there already are. So what am I doing? And I need sort of almost like, meditative principles that guide me so I know what the point of it would be. So they have a reason for doing things. So yeah, food for thought was sort of part of that, like a thinking through of the need to do anything relating to poetry, especially something under my name instead of just being a reader, which I feel like so many other people do. Reading and writing are, you know, really interrelated. It's not just like, I want to do this and I want to do that. They really mesh together, and I wanted poems that drew on other poems and other kinds of thought to create a texture that accurately reflects that kind of thinking that goes into a poem. So this was one of them. I felt like it was these poems in Squandermania. Squandermania is kind of my orphan book in a lot of ways. I feel like it just kind of sort of fell through the cracks and was weird in a lot of ways, and I don't, you know.
Oh, that's interesting.
As time goes by, I'm not sure what to make of it anymore, but anyway,
maybe
that's the long...
Maybe it's because people don't know what the word means.
Well, it's funny, yeah. It's a real word. I never make up words, though I think it's fine if poets do that, but I would never make up a word. I actually got it from The Economist. Do you know, we go through these unbelievable whiplash cycles of economic sort of ups and downs. We just had one. We've had them repeatedly. All of us remember this. And yeah, in the face of all of the sort of class and economic constraints on everybody that so many of us are obviously complicit in to support our own way of living, you see that people in many senses squander everything away, while at the same time people need things from us. I mean, that's in the news every day. People need the basics, don't get them, and lives are lost on at an incredible rate for the lack of the simplest basics. And at the same time, our complex lifestyle consists of a mania for squandering what we have, squandering money, squandering resources, squandering the environment, squandering peace, squandering everything we have. We sort of, we're in a frenzy to, you know, sort of run through everything till there, it seems like nothing can be sustained anymore. And so that book was trying to poke at things like that. What do we do in the middle of that? I mean, you know, it doesn't do to be helpless, doesn't do to complain. So I just felt like the language we use was instrumentally complicit first and foremost, because we become immune to what the world and the people in it are trying to say. And so the language that, you know, poets like Hopkins do that, like they stress the language, you know, when they're stressed, they apply stress to the language. Because what is the language for times like ours? If there are still people here in 50 and 100 years from now or more, they're going to say, what were these people doing while all that happened? What were they thinking? What were they writing? And so I continually ask myself when I read submissions, when I read poetry for my own sake and write it, you know, what is the language for this? It's a search, right? And so food for thought. I was like, how can I keep thought going in a world where everything is being squandered relentlessly by all of us? So the poem is one of a bunch of them in that book. Where, so all the things in the book were sort of designed to sort of, locate that. So they're not sort of in what you would call, or Marianne Moore would say, plain English that cats and dogs can understand. You know, I don't feel like we have the luxury. That's just my view, the luxury to indulge in that. The language has to sort of be invented for what's happening. You know, it didn't exist. You know, we have to, the poets, I think, and other writers have to create the language that we can use to talk about this stuff and do something. I mean, really do something off the page.
You know, let me ask you then, before you read the poem, because you're going into a territory that I'm actually really interested in right now.
Huh?
I'd love to just say something about it while we're on it. So, I mean, this is an incredibly sort of dynamic and fragile and even explosive time with racial issues and police violence and everything that's going on right now. And, you know, there is kind of a heated debate in the poetry community right now about whether or not literary activism is real activism, whether or not the arts, whether or not poetry, whether or not it actually has the power to affect any kind of change in the quote-unquote real world. But, you know, seeing the work that you do, and judging by what you just said, I feel that maybe you do believe in the power of
I believe it fervently and passionately, and I've witnessed it. You know, there is a kind of it's not real activism, but it's a kind of calling out culture, where if people just weigh in on a tweet or on Facebook or a blog post, they just say something. It's important for people to say something. That's the first level of activism. But just saying things is too easy. It doesn't necessarily change things. And a lot of people pile on. And there's a kind of a vocalization that is invidious, which is a great word, that is as divisive and harmful, even as much as it may be well-intentioned and right and just. So we have to be careful. But I'll give you examples. I mean, anybody who's not just read, but seen, you know, Ocean Vuong do a reading. I've seen Ocean and Dennis Smith do readings where people are just, you know, they're crying. They are never the same after they see. Those are just two poets who come to mind. There are many, many more I can name, and you could too. I've seen poets change people in the room. And I know that when people leave the room and the best poets have spoken to them, they aren't the same. And so that really, you know, that really can happen. I don't think every poet is cut out for that or needs to do that. You know, Wallace Stevens wasn't going to go out in the world and change it. But what we all do when poetry is at its best is we activate the imagination. Because to solve problems and to create a world in which any kind of justice obtains, the imagination has to work. You have to imagine solutions to terrible problems, complex problems. There's no one size fits all in anything in the world, as well as language, activism. And our reality needs the kind of imagination that poets are trying to connect with and at their best really do. But I've seen it. I've seen people who've never been the same. When I've seen Louder Than a Bomb here in Chicago, or the breakbeat poet, when I see those guys doing what they're doing, nobody is ever the same. They go out into the world and they are different. So that's just the sort of foundation for what could happen and what I hope will happen.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I've seen it too. I've seen it too.
Yeah.
I've heard from people too. I mean, I have a friend who, who wrote a book about, a poetry book about some abuse that she suffered as a child. And she actually has people who write her and tell her that they were thinking of committing suicide and now they don't feel so alone and afraid anymore. I mean, it literally saved their life. You know?
I think we often have a sense of activism as having to affect many people at once, which is a tall order mm-hmm. and very hard to accomplish. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's sort of a trite thing to say. But if you change one person mm-hmm. here, one person here, the cumulative effect is extraordinary. Because you never know who might be saved and redeemed to be able to go out in the world and do something you can't, you know, somebody who...
becomes a teacher.
A teacher, a lawyer like Duane Betts, mm-hmm. a philosopher, mm-hmm. somebody who's working in the trenches. Just think of all the different roles people play in life. And to get somebody to a point where, whether it's poetry or any other kind of articulation, empowers them to be what they really could be and give them courage, mm-hmm. give them hope, give them a way to say things maybe they didn't have before, then they can go into this troubled world and do something. And, you know, you have to believe if enough people find empowerment in poetry, but also politics and other walks of life, the law, whatever we're good at doing, if we find our way to that, I think the world will be different. It may not be better, you know, in the largest sense, but it will be better for some people. And I think we are absolutely morally obliged to do those things to the utmost of our capability. Mm. I mean, if I were a doctor, I would, you know, want to save lives. If I could do that, if I, you know, had a legal mind, I would want to use that for just purposes. I think poets always feel like, well, we're just poets, but that's not, you know, I feel like we should have bigger ambitions than that. I think a poet should want to change the world. I don't know of a poet who doesn't write out of an impulse to say the world could be better. That's sort of the mm-hmm. plot of every decent poem, in a way. Why isn't the world better?
yeah, well... Well, okay. Will you read it?
I will. Food for thought. Never weaned from anger, the stars incline but do not require. Left alone, she thinks hard. Thoughts mean as snow at harvest. Home is paradise to cats. Hell for wives, she thinks. Are all babies slippery? Boys hate old men, but women despise them, she thinks, bed full of bones, and bad usage aggravates the matter. She had a smack of this disease. Like Vulcan, he made creaking shoes for his Venus. That is to say, being bloodthirsty, nature turns leaves red every single fall, and she thinks love more violent. Even Noah, Jerome says, showed his nakedness and his drunkenness, which for 600 years he had covered in his soberness. So what can she do with his scores of years for scruples? The sailor doesn't see the water passing underneath his ship. The fisherman, all the fish deep in the sea around his nets. So she thinks, nothing will ever be my own, not even time, and feeds herself more thoughts, the way ravens fed Elijah, invisible, invisible, invisible.
Thank you. It does exactly what I was talking about earlier when I was describing the effect of your poems. I just, you know, kind of float away with it.
Well, it's kind of an angry poem. I'm not the one who's angry. I mean, mm-hmm. it's kind of the experience that women have when they must raise children, give birth, mm-hmm. raise children, hold down. If you look all over the world, the images in the most troubled places, you see women having to pay the price for the violence that occurs, whether it's domestic violence or warfare or poverty. It's women mm-hmm. who have to convert all kinds of emotions and disadvantages into a world that makes it possible for somebody else to survive. And that's the hardest work known.
Thank you so much for being with us today. We hope you'll join us again for part two when we speak more with poet and editor Dawn Scher.